It's not every day you get a chance to talk with somebody with the credentials of Dr. John DeSalvo. He has studied the Shroud of Turin, he heads up the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, and he has several marvelous new works out, of course, The Lost Art of Enochian Magic, Decoding the Enochian Secrets as well. We're going to talk about all of that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John DeSalvo, Ph.D., director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, formerly a college professor and dean of student affairs. He has taught biochemistry, anatomy, physiology, general biology, neurophysiology for more than 20 years. He was one of the scientists involved in studying the Shroud of Turin as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, a favorite, Dr. John DeSalvo. John, how are you?
Hey, pretty good, George. Listen, it's a pleasure to be back on Coast to Coast.
Oh, my
pleasure. Nice talking to you again.
We've missed you. What have you been doing?
Yeah, I can't believe it's been that long. I think it's several
years
since I've been on Coast.
2 years?
Yeah, I think it was the Lincoln Bicentennial I was on last, and I can't believe time went so quickly.
And, it was so long ago, Lincoln was giving the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah, I hate to say I was probably present at it, too. So.
You know, as we are getting close to Easter, I can't believe how fast this year is already going. I want to take just a few minutes to talk with you about the Shroud of Turin.
Sure.
Any more new research there, John?
You know, I hate to say this. Every time I kind of check and look into it, it seems like there's another footnote on a footnote. And the important research that needs to be done hasn't been done. That is redoing the carbon-14 tests, you know, and that's what's so frustrating, because it could answer so many questions. And maybe with, you know, the time the tests were done in 1978, you know, we're talking about decades later. The science has improved so much. We could learn so much from the Shroud. So that's kind of the frustration. It would be really nice to go back and do additional testing. So, you know, like I said, I haven't been impressed with any of the new works. Everybody seems to have a theory, but very few people have the facts to substantiate it.
Is the Vatican withholding any information? Are they holding back, giving us the ability to study the Shroud?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's there's any conspiracy or reason why they're not doing it. But, I mean, you know, they could tomorrow say, okay, we're going to open the Shroud up and you can and have a certified team of scientists. They could even pick the group, you know, and approve it and approve the test. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe just things go slowly there. They're afraid of destructive testing. But a lot of this, you know, besides the carbon-14, a lot of the test is non-destructive. So, I don't know. I'm guessing a lot of it is just politics and who knows what. I mean, I wish I did know, because maybe if we did, we could solve it. But that's what's frustrating. And, you know, to me, the most important test was the carbon-14. And remember, because in 1988, when it was the carbon-14 was done by three different labs.
Right, yeah.
It came out to be a medieval date, anywhere from like, you know, 1260 to 1390, and that kind of brought a lot of questions. It's a shroud of forgery, you know. But since then, I think, in fact, even when I think when I was on the show last, we talked about it, that the sample was most was taken from the side of the cloth, and we feel there's evidence that that was the side strip that was later added to maybe like center the image, because it was always held up in exposition. So the sample may not have been a piece of cloth from the actual shroud. So that's why we need to do another carbon-14 testing and maybe take a sample from more towards the center, or from a piece of the shroud that we know was the original shroud.
You're a scientist, but I'm going to ask you, what does your gut tell you about the Shroud of Turin?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think at this point, there has been really no evidence showing it is a forgery or a fake or was painted. I mean, I know there's so many people have come out with different methods of how they feel it was reproduced. But when you look at all the data together, so that's the one thing I think as a scientist, I like to look at all the data and not just a little piece here or there. You talk about how it's a negative, how it has three-dimensional information encoding in it. Nothing has really been shown to be a fake with the shroud. So my gut feeling is it's an authentic burial cloth, whether it's of Jesus Christ, or how old it is, we don't know. But I think that's the first step. You find something that's a modern production, whether it's modern pigments, like in the Vinland map, they found a modern pigment and they ruled it out as being ancient. But nothing like that has been found on the shroud. And you know, George, and I don't care, all the people that claim to have reproduced it artistically doesn't come near what we see on the shroud. So that's my gut feeling. You know, as a scientist, obviously, I would say we just don't know yet. We need to do more testing. But my intuition tells me there's something authentic about it. I was drawn to this back in the 70s for some reason. It was almost an intuition to that this is something very special. And I kind of still feel that way today.
Me too. I have just been enamored with it ever since I saw pictures of it in a book. And I can't stop but wonder, John, what it means to humanity if and when we finally authenticate it and let the world know that this truly was the shroud on a very miraculous person.
Yeah. It's really funny, too, because I never knew anything about the shroud. And I remember, it was back in the 70s, I was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins at the time, and I came home on vacation, and my wife had a cousin over. I can't even remember his name. It's been so long ago. And he had these pictures of the shroud. He was so excited about it, and he showed me them. And it just hit me like, wow, this is just something beyond art or photography. There's something there. And again, I'm not psychic. I've never been psychic, but it's just something that just hit me. And that actually got me started, where I found out that Father Peter Rinaldi, the one who was responsible for all the studies in the 1978 Turin scientific testing, and who organized pretty much the team, was living in the next town. And believe it or not, George, my mother-in-law knew him. They were fairly good friends. And that's what started, basically. I said, boy, I'd like to meet this person, so maybe someday I can tell my grandchildren I met Father Peter Rinaldi. And that's at that time, he recruited me. He asked me to get a new team together. And, that's been like 30 years of my life. It's interesting how one meeting with an important person can do that. He was just very impressive. Well, and I miss him very much. He was a great mentor.
Maybe one day we'll get the answers about the Shroud of Turin, John. Huh?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I do feel that Rome and the Archbishop and all the people involved do want to know. I believe they are open. They're not trying to hide anything, and I just kind of feel maybe same with Giza. The politics is just so overwhelming, it's hard to get anything moving.
What's going to happen with Zahi Hawass now?
You know, it's funny. I knew you were going to ask me that, and I kind of was searching the internet to see if I could find out any information, and couldn't find anything. I have a contact. One of our board members is in Cairo, but I haven't been able to reach him except during all the upheaval. I know he wrote to me, and he was kind of glad there was this big change there. But I've been thinking about that almost every day. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful to get in a new a person who's just open
and proactive?
Oh, God.
Not self-serving. You know, Zahi's an electrifying guy. He's been on the program before. He loves what he's doing, but he was just never open-minded. You know, he wouldn't talk about what Edgar Cayce talked about, and that was the Hall of Records at the foot of the Sphinx. The mere mention of the possibility of a super technology or ET help, and you don't have to believe that, but at least it's worth an open mind. I mean, he closed his door to all that stuff, John.
You know, I agree. You know, he's done wonderful good in promoting the Great Pyramid and the Giza Plateau, and in fact, all of Egyptian antiquities. He's a great spokesman. He's got that personality, But yes, he has prevented, I feel, so many studies. There's always the question, have there been secret research and digging going on that we don't know about? I mean, I don't have any reason to believe that, but there's so much questions about that. And I think it would be nice to have, like you say, somebody who is open. And, you know, it was really funny. You mentioned, ARE. I was a member for many years. Again, I love Edgar Cayce's work, and when I did my book on Andrew Jackson Davis, the ARE supplied me with hundreds and hundreds of documents of Andrew Jackson Davis, so I have the highest respect for them and for the work of Cayce. I thought Zahi at one time was even supported by them in his research or his graduate work, so it's really interesting how he doesn't seem more of an interest, and again, like a scientist, I'm open-minded, but Yeah, I agree with you, George. Maybe the change is coming, and let's hope it's going to be for the good.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I suspect he's in trouble. You know, I don't want them to hurt the guy, but if they're going to make a change, they're going to make a change, and let's hope it's somebody who's very proactive and wants to find some of these answers, unravel some of these answers and questions that we all have.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I would never wish ill on anyone, and I hope everything's a positive transition. Yeah. The other thing about Giza, I think, I'm not sure if you realize, but Joe Parr passed away, a research director.
He was a great friend of yours, wasn't he?
He was. And, you know, I tell you, he loved the show. He loved Coast to Coast. And whenever I was going to go on with you and talk about his research, it meant the world to him because it took him 30, 40 years. And I was just talking to his daughter this week, and we were saying, yeah, I know Joe will be listening to the show, and he'll be saying, thank you, you know, George, for putting my research out and allowing John to come on.
He may have been one of the few people to go on top of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, to do some of his electrical studies, wasn't he?
Yeah, one night in 1977, he spent the whole night on top of the Great Pyramid, and 10 years later, in 1987, he spent another whole night up there, and he did all kinds of scientific studies, electromagnetic, I can't remember all of them, but he did a whole barrage of testing, and I think he's the only person that actually did that. One thing, I don't know if I ever mentioned this on the show, I know I never published it in the book either, you know, you have so much information with Joe Parr, but he thought the top of the Great Pyramid may have had the most energy. He was getting the most intense electromagnetic readings up there. And I thought that was interesting because the question of was there a capstone or not? Was that the center place for the pyramid? And, I hope to someday go into more of Joe's diaries and notes and find out. There's probably tons and tons of information that we don't even know about that he discovered.
Yeah, I think it probably had a gold capstone. I think it was just taken down over the years. They stole it.
Yeah, we know that the casing stone was stripped to make mosques and buildings in Egypt, and especially if the capstone was valuable, like if it was gold or precious metal. Another theory was, I find this fascinating, is that maybe you need the capstone for the pyramid to do whatever it does, and it's hidden, and someday it'll be discovered, so it could be repositioned. So, I mean, there's so many fascinating theories about it, but I asked Joe did he think there could have been a capstone or not? And, you know, we're not sure. I think he felt there was remnants of cement or something up there that would indicate it. And I can't see why it wouldn't have been finished. Look, if the casing stone was totally probably finished on it, why wouldn't the top be finished? So I think it was a completed structure.
When you're up near the top of the Great Pyramid, how small do you look in relation to the pyramid?
Oh gee, I
mean, do you look like a little bug?
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. You know, the one thing I like to mention about it, that when the pyramid was finished with its casing stone, which is polished limestone that completely covered it, which is gone now, the calculations show that if you were on the moon looking on the Earth, it would look like a star. The pyramid in the sun would have glistened, and it would look like a star on the Earth. So that gives you an idea of how magnificent it must have been. But I would think so, because, you know, it's look when you're on the Empire State Building, you know, and you look down, and as a kid, I always wanted to throw something off the top, you know, see what kind of terminal velocity it would make. You know?
How do you think the Great Pyramid itself, and then the other two near it, how do you think it was built?
Well, again, I'll give you my opinion. You know, I have no evidence to support it. First of all, I don't think anybody knows how it was built.
No, I don't either.
If you want to, you know, I mean, in terms of science.
Great theories, but I don't think anybody really knows.
Exactly. Now, my theory is that once you kind of rule out all the traditional methods of technology and, I mean, ancient technology and this and that, I always come back to levitation. And people think, oh, that's mysterious and occultish. It's not. Levitation has been done. Bell Labs and others have levitated small objects with sound and resonance. And I think it's just a matter of time until the technology is perfected that we could move large objects. Also, there's a lot of Arab legends of the pyramid blocks being moved by sound. and I mean, several legends that go back to the medieval times. And it also scientifically makes sense. You know, the calculations show that, you know, since there's over a million blocks of limestone, and look how the interior passages were cut, you know, you'd have to lay a block every, like, 80 seconds for 20 years to build the pyramid, which is an impossibility. So, and then the idea of the ramps using to bring the bricks up, the ramps would have had to be, the whole structure would have had to have been bigger than a Great Pyramid. So the only thing that's left is that, and then, you know, Coral Castle.
Yeah, you know, Lead Scotland's place, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of the circumstantial evidence, in my opinion, points to some kind of levitation, historically, mythology, even scientifically. And that's my guess. And who knows, maybe we'll discover something in one of those hidden chambers that have information on how the Great Pyramid was built. That, you know, that would be wonderful to find some ancient documents, which we haven't. So that's kind of my theory. It's total speculation, but I kind of base it on what I know.
Well, you know, there had to be some kind of architectural schematic put on papyrus, for example. They had to draw this out before they built it, don't you think?
That's a good point. I never thought of that. Yeah, actually, exactly. Whether it was on papyrus or I doubt they would do it on bricks and stone, because they would, you know, like an architect would want to bring it around.
You got to show it to people.
Interesting. And then, you know, maybe it was tradition, like in many buildings, to bury the original plans with the building, or put them in a secret chamber.
I'm telling you, it's in the Hall of Records.
Maybe under the, you know, we talk about the Sphinx. Remember, they found through that there's possibly a cavity through remote sensing, you know, and maybe it'll be found there, maybe in one of the air shafts, you know, in the Queen's chambers that end by the doors with the two handles. Who knows? I mean, it's just, that's what's so exciting about it. I mean, you're bringing up things that are just, you know, why people like me and others get interested in these mysteries, because there's no explanation. You know, again, how was the pyramid built? Why was it built? Who built it? You know, these are all wonderful questions. Unfortunately, I don't think we really have any definitive answers, except I will speculate that we're talking about old, and old meaning not only thousands, but it could be 10,000s of years old, an ancient culture we never even knew about.
Absolutely. And again, I think you brought up so correctly so the Edward Leeds Scaldon episode, where he said he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built. And this guy, I think, did the same thing. He moved tons of blocks by himself in minutes. Impossible.
You know, here's the other interesting thing. You're exactly right. And he was a little guy, you know. I mean,
it's 120 pounds.
Yeah, there were stories like they would bring the blocks on a truck, and he was by himself, and he would tell the driver, go away for a couple minutes, and then the driver would come back, and the blocks would be on the ground, because he didn't want to see. And people would, like, spy on him, and he would know that. And the other interesting story, one of my friends who was a researcher said he was down to that place, I think in the 70s or before it was really made into a tourist place, and he found wires all over the ground buried and stuff. And so it does seem there was some kind of technology that he used. It wasn't purely like a mind thing or some kind of psychic power, but it seemed like he had developed some type of technology to do that. I find that interesting. You know, it's too bad many times the original locations and places are disturbed and moved, and we lose a lot of the original information we could have maybe solved the mystery with.
How'd you love to have him on as a guest with us, John, on Coast to Coast?
Oh, God. Actually, I prefer Napoleon and find out what he experienced in the King's Chamber.
You know what? If we could develop some kind of time machine and pull back these guests and interview them on the program, that would be a great show.
That'd be a good Pulitzer Prize, too. Hey, listen, Joe Parr, before he passed away, believed the pyramid was used also as some kind of time travel device, even calculated some of the possibilities with it. And we never really got far with that. So you may be right on. It's interesting you mentioned that, because that was one of Joe was really sure of that. And he just was looking for the right evidence, never was able to prove it, but I think he was working in that direction. Interesting.
John, when we come back, we'll talk about the lost art of Enochian magic and decoding the Enochian secrets. Get ready. Well, are you a Coast Insider? You can be for just 25 cents a day, even less in some cases. You might want to go up to coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at the highlight reel. It's revolving there with pictures. If you become a Coast Insider, you will get to participate this coming Tuesday on our first live video chat. How about that? So information up there at coasttocoastam.com. Well, hello there. We're with Dr. John DeSalvo, and we're talking about Enochian magic. And last hour of the program, we'll take your phone calls with John. John, before we get into this, tell us about Enoch. Who was he?
Yes. Well, Enoch was is actually mentioned in the Bible in Genesis. He was a actually, there's a list of like 10 names, a genealogy in a sense, that goes from Adam to Noah. And Enoch is the seventh one mentioned. Who, why he was unusual was the Bible says, well, this person was born, he lived so many years, he had these many kids, and then died. But with Enoch, he wasn't died. He was supposedly, he walked with God and was taken up to the heavens. So he was one of the few people like Elijah in the Bible that didn't die, but taken up to the heavens. Now, there was an apocryphal book of Enoch, which was actually you can actually go out and buy it. It's a book that didn't make the canon of the Bible. You know, there are a lot of books that didn't make the books that we currently have in the Bible, and that was one of them. Right. But it basically told of Enoch's travels in the heavens and the fallen angels and so many different stories, George, that actually we use today in our theology. In fact, the Catholic Church bases much of its theology on angelology, the study of angels, from the book of Enoch and the fallen angels. So it had an effect, but it never made the canon of the Bible. Now, there's a legend that...
And he was the great-grandfather of Noah, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, exactly. And the legend has it that there was a book or language or some kind of communication thing that God gave Adam after the fall. In fact, the legend has it the angel Raziel gave it to Adam. What was this? Was it a book? Was it some kind of communications device? And supposedly that was lost, and then Enoch was giving this information, and then that was lost, and then Dr. John Dee, the 16th century Renaissance mathematician and occultist, was given this information, which we believe was the original book of Enoch, not the book that, the apocryphal book that didn't make into the Bible, but the real book of Enoch that God wanted mankind to have. So that's kind of where Enoch stands, and it's important to keep in mind that there are two separate books we kind of refer to. One is the apocryphal book, which you can actually go out and buy, and one apocryphal book that didn't make it into the Bible. And the other, the lost book of Enoch, which is what I based my books on.
Okay. How do we know he was real, John, and not a myth?
That's a good question, because I believe, again, many stories in the Bible were myths. They're used to teach a theological lesson, so it's not actual history. I don't know if it really matters that much, to be honest with you, because the idea is the material was the book. It's possible another person received it, and he used the name Enoch. Like a lot of the books of the Bible, they were given pseudonames because it wasn't considered plagiarism to take a famous name as the author of the book you're writing. It gave it authority. So it's possible he was a myth, and it was basically an event that happened that was attributed to him. So we really don't know. We really don't know for sure. It's actually a very good question.
Now, tell us a little bit about your interest in the Enochian magic.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you asked me how did I get from biophysics to Enochian magic,
yeah.
I mean, it's like if you told me I was going to write a book on magic 10 years ago, I think you were crazy. Well, you know, I want to say something I think will really resonate with your Coast audience. I mean, I've been a seeker all my life for truth, for God, for that nirvana.
The answer.
The answer, exactly. And I actually say started my spiritual search in junior high, if not earlier. I was probably one of the first listeners to Coast back 25 years ago. I mean, why do people listen to Coast? Why do people go out and buy these books? Because I was looking for answers. I was looking for answers from your guests, from books. I probably, in the last 30 or 40 years of my life, have bought every how to do book on developing your psychic ability, astral projection.
Yeah, me too.
You name it. I was going to say, I bet a lot of listeners can relate to this. The problem was, I really didn't have any gift or natural ability for this, and none of this stuff really seemed to work. And it was frustrating because you get to the point and you say, I give up. But there's that interior drive, that something within you saying, no, continue to search. You will find it. The whole goal in life is to find God, the truth. So I didn't give up. I kept trying and trying until I decided to look. You know, one thing I haven't looked at was magic. So I thought, well, let me try that. And I bought the typical ritual magic books and tried the different things. And, you know, nothing again seemed to work. Then I tried something known as Enochian magic. And the books out there about it were very good. In fact, a good friend of mine, Lon Milo Duquette, who actually wrote the foreword to my book, to me, he's one of the greatest Enochian magicians, really helped me with this, and I have to thank him and give him credit. But I took the techniques that were out there, and I kind of stripped them of everything that wasn't essential, things that man had added, not what I felt the magic that was given to Enoch, the original Enoch magic was. So I stripped it down to the original basics and found out that the original power of the magic was called the Enochian call, words that you recite that basically opens up higher dimensions. So, you know, without getting too far ahead, this is the reason I got interested in it and why I wrote the book, because this technique, which I did when I stripped it of all the basics, of all the non-essentials, found out what the true pronunciation was of the Enochian code was, it just ripped open the veil. And I was basically had a altered state of consciousness. I experienced, in my opinion, the presence of the angels. And it was like after 40 years kind of finally saying, my God, I found something that really worked. And the first thing I thought is, I got to bring this out to the public, to others, because there are people like me that have been searching, have been frustrated. I mean, will it work for everyone? Of course not. I bet I'm hoping it would work for many people. I don't think anything's going to work for everybody. So that's kind of how I launched into this strange area called Enochian magic.
When I was younger, when I would hear phrases like that, Enochian magic, alchemy, first of all, with alchemists, I thought it was merely people trying to make gold. And like Enochian magic, you would think of people like Doug Henning and David Copperfield and people like that.
Yes.
Not the case at all, is it?
No, again, make sure that people understand this is not the magic tricks. This is magic in a sense. The true definition of magic was a spiritual technique or process to unite yourself with God, to bring yourself to the higher spiritual realms. And that's what, there's a lot of different aspects of Enochian magic. I focused on the one area that opens up higher realms and allows you to enter those and communicate with the angels. Now, you know, as a scientist, a lot of people say, well, you know, how do you know it's not in your imagination and subconscious? And it's a very good question. I have been doing meditation, Eastern meditation, since the 1970s. In fact, many years ago, I had a doctor hook me up to a medical monitoring device to see how I could change my physiology. And I was pretty much significantly able to change my EEG, GSR, well, you know, the body physiology, mm-hmm. that pretty significant. I kind of, you know, impressed him. Well, teaching physiology and knowing the feelings I get when the values change, I can pretty much know what's happening when I meditate. The first time I did the Enochian magic, which I made it into a meditation, by the way, it's another change I made to it, I felt my body physiology changed by twofold after 30 or 40 years of meditation, just at one time. It was like, wow.
Why was this so different from other times?
I don't know, but the meditation, I think the Enochian call is like a mantra, but it's a long mantra and a specific mantra that the angels gave that resonates with certain specific areas of your brain in your cortical areas and opens up dormant receptors that allow one to enter these realms and see these these angels or these beings, that it's a real reality. It's not something of the imagination. So the process may be similar. You know, you go into an altered state of consciousness, but the depth of the altered state of consciousness that I got with the Enochian meditation, the first time was like twice as deep as in my Eastern meditation. It's amazing. I couldn't believe it.
Did you find yourself in a different subconsciousness?
Yeah, it was like a different state. Again, it was really hard to explain. It all of a sudden, it's like being in a different place. You know, you're conscious.
Like another dimension?
Yeah, in a sense. Yeah, you're conscious of your physical body, but you're in a different, maybe that's the best way to explain it. And then the other interesting thing was, I did sense the presence of other beings, and that's part of the Enochian magic, that once you enter a higher realm, and supposedly they're divided into 30 different realms, from the lowest up to the furthest, which is God. So it goes from 30, 29, 28 to 1.
And the lowest is what, hell?
No, that's where, no, they're considered all heavenly realms. It's the first one that our physical world borders on, up to God. Like, you start with the earth, the physical realm, then you go from 30...
It's like the
one.
Bottom of a ladder. That's
right. Okay. But you know, the 30th one is like, you know, when we get sometimes feelings of intuition, or we see certain kind of mystical things. That's kind of we're moving into that, not even realizing it. But with the meditation, the Enochian meditation allows you to go completely into it. So it wouldn't be that foreign to many people. That's why it's fairly safe. The first realm we call it's called Aethers, a heavenly realm, is very comfortable. But right away, I felt the presence of the angels. Now, each of the realms supposedly is governed by three or four angels or governors, they call them. The 30th has four, and the 29th to the 1st have three. And I could actually sense the presence of four different beings that each had different types of personalities. And I call them in my book flavors, because it's like, you know, if you meet somebody, they may have a certain cologne you recognize. They wear a certain outfit. You recognize them. They have a flavor. Well, these angels had flavors, and I could tell which one was, you know, I was interacting with, and they had different kind of attributes, and that was really amazing. And so that's when I thought, my God, and Lon Milo Duquette said to me, you know, Enochian magic is so powerful that even somebody with no magical or psychic ability, that it would work for them. And I thought, yeah, that's me, somebody with no psychic ability. And it really worked. So that's why now the thing is, what's nice about the technique, the way I brought it into a meditation, and that's why I don't call it Enochian magic, I call it Enochian meditation. I got rid of anything superficial, like the ritual equipment that people use in magical rituals. All you do is sit in a chair with the book, and you do the Enochian call. You just read through it, and you do the procedure. You don't have to take classes. You don't have to get equipment. And like I said, I think the possibility of it working is very high, because it's so simple. Dr. John Dee, as I mentioned, in the 16th century, was given this information by the angels. Dee was probably the most intelligent person that was living in that Renaissance period. He was a mathematician, a cartographer, a cryptologist, a scientist. He had the largest library in the world. He was the advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. When he was in his 50s, he realized, maybe like us, you're not going to find the answers to life through the normal physical world, you know,
right,
the sciences. You've got to go to higher levels. So that's when he decided to try to contact the angels to get these answers. And again, I have the whole story about it in my book. But the bottom line is, the angels did contact him through, he worked with a person known as Edward Kelly, who was his scryer, who could actually look into crystals and see visions and have the ability to contact the angels better than Dee. And together, they put together, over a period of many years in the 1580s, the whole Enochian system of magic. And that's what came down to us to the present. But magical groups like the Golden Dawn and the OTO and many others have embellished them with their rituals and different things. And no, maybe that's helpful for certain people, but I always like the simplest thing and how it was originally meant to be used. And I believe It was just simply the Enochian call that would open up the higher realms. You didn't need all these other things. And if they're helpful for you, that's great. It's almost like, say, going to church. You know, some people need the singing and the incense and the fellowship. And
it's like a motivation for them.
Yeah, and others, like me, I prefer to just walk into a church by myself and pray, or sit in my chair at home and pray. And So I'm not saying what's good for me is good for others, but I found out if you got rid of all these different things, it just allows you to center on the technique. So that's kind of how I fell into this. I would be the last one to think something like this would just rip the veil between the physical and the spiritual for me. And I've done this hundreds of times. I've never experienced anything negative with it. I feel it is good and holy, and that it does bring us closer to God. And I would never, ever publish anything or promote anything that I thought had any negative, you know, or evil influence.
Well, no, that's not you. You know, yeah. You're not like a Satanist.
You know, I don't think so.
Far from it. Let's assume for a moment, John, that Enoch was real, okay?
Okay.
Physical person. These stories that he kind of ascended away, something happened. I don't know what it was, but something very mystical happened to this person, didn't it?
I agree. And here's the reason why. If you read the Book of Enoch, and by the way, it's a really fun read. It's a really big book. You can, you know, find it on the internet. But the apocryphal Book of Enoch says, you know, he was taken up and he was brought to each of the seven heavens. And he was brought back to earth to record what happened for posterity and for others. So, yes, I believe he did experience something. Because, look, there were a lot of people that walked with God. They weren't taken up to heaven. They died naturally. Why was Enoch so special? I always say I don't believe it was because he was such a great person. I believe God had a mission for him. Why does God take people sometimes that aren't the greatest saints for missions? We don't know. That's God's free will. But I think he was taken up to heaven, and he was made to experience all these realms so he could give it to us. Now,
can you put an ET spin on this for some reason? Is it possible?
Sure. Why not? I mean, look at Ezekiel, right?
Right.
I mean, when you read Ezekiel, I mean, it's hard not to say that was an ET. And by the way, later when we talk about, when we get into, hopefully some of my crystal skulls.
Yeah, we'll do crystal skulls next hour.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about some of that because one of my closest friends is Betty and Becky Andreessen, and I've been working with them for many years.
Great abductee case.
Exactly.
It is. I think it's as strong as the Barney and Betty Hill case.
I do, too, and I've known them personally for many years. I've done a lot of research with Becky, and something, one aspect of my research you may not have been aware of, but hopefully that'll fit in more when we talk about crystal skulls. But when you talk about an alien connection, I'm a firm believer that there's something happening out there. Now, whether they're alien, extraterrestrial, interdimensional travelers, I don't know, but I definitely believe that there's something strange, and there is some kind of alien energy. So,
negate a God by any means.
Not at all. I mean, in fact, how do we know the angels aren't involved in this also? It may be, I always say, you know, in physics we look for a unified field theory to have one equation to explain how weak and strong and forces work, you know, gravity and quantum physics. I think there's a unified psychic energy theory that will explain how all psychic activity works. In fact, remember with the pyramid research with the Russians that I've done for many years, Dr. Kay, one of the great Ukrainian researchers, was involved trying to study this, and he believed that the energy field that was involved with the pyramids and psychic energy is one and the same, and he was working on that. I don't know how far he's got, but George, I mean, this all could come together and a simple type of energy, a simple explanation that is actually very scientific.
Well, let's talk about some angels when we come back, John. And later on in the hour, we will get into the crystal skulls and also some of your work in the physics of all of this. And we'll get into that abductee story. It's a fascinating one. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.